If you remember, Paul is presently in Jerusalem. He, in chapter 21, he was in the temple. He was praying, and there were some men from Asia Minor that seized him. They grabbed him and started beating him up. And one of the soldiers saw what was going on, that a riot was getting started, a man was getting beaten. So they run over and they stop everything. And they're about to take him into the barracks, the chief captain is. And as Paul is so bloodied and beaten, he has to be carried up the stairs. He asks for permission to speak to the crowd that had just beaten him. And so they thought that he was an Egyptian leader of a rebellion, is what the Roman soldiers thought, or that chief captain did. And so he asked them, "Can you speak Greek?" And he said, "Yes." And so then Paul stands up there and begins to address the crowd who had just beaten him. And it makes a note in chapter 20, the beginning of chapter 22, that he began to speak in the Hebrew tongue. So everybody kept silent and they started listening to everything he had to say. And so this is the second account where Paul tells his testimony. So Acts chapter 9 is the first account. Acts chapter 22 is the second account. And this is before all these men who had tried to beat him and put him to death. And so we tried to note in the last lesson that we taught that there are some differences in the details of the testimony that he gives. And a lot of that seems that he is trying to design his testimony or the facts of his testimony to fit the crowd. Right? That if you're telling it originally, Luke the narrator is, it's different than when he's standing before this crowd of Jewish people, and that's different than when he's standing in front of King Agrippa and a bunch of Gentiles. And so one of the things that he emphasizes here is in verse 5, and you can look on the Acts 22 outline. He talks about being given permission, and he references the letters that he received from the high priest and the estates of the elders. So they're there present. The Sanhedrin is present with them. And so he's basically saying, those guys right there can testify, the ones behind this attempt to assassinate me can testify. I receive letters from them to be able to do this. And in this way, he emphasizes his education. If you remember, he says, "I was a student of Gamaliel." So in this way, he's connecting to this little more intellectual audience, this Jewish audience, and trying to make this connection with them as he continues to preach or tell his testimony, rather. He also references Stephen, which is a noteworthy fact because these men were likely the ones that put Stephen to death. And so the fact that he would include this detail makes a lot of sense. Let's see here. He, at the end of chapter 22, the main thing that we highlight about this, or that the scriptures highlight rather, is that as the chief captain is about to take him away and interrogate him by beating him and scourging him, he asks, "Are you allowed to do this to a Roman, essentially?" And all of a sudden, the chief captain gets scared because he realizes, "I'm violating Roman law, which does not permit me to do this until we have a proper trial." And so we kind of see a shift in the balance of power, right? That we got to take this into consideration. And so basically, the chief captain says, "All right, this is causing me a lot of trouble. I'm going to take this to the courts. Right? I'm not going to deal with this, likely because it was not within his jurisdiction to deal with." And so, but before he does that, he's trying to get it reconciled with the Pharisees and Sadducees, so the Sanhedrin court. So what he's going to try to do is, it's almost like he takes it to mediation. So you know, in our present court system, before you go to a judge, a lot of times you'll sit down with an attorney and they'll try to mediate between the two parties and settle it before it goes to court. And so this seems like this is what the chief counsel is doing, or the chief captain is doing. He's bringing it before the council. Hey, let's get this figured out so we don't have to appeal to the higher court. Now, what we're going to know is this eventually fails. Doesn't work, but this is in chapter 23. Paul standing before the Sanhedrin. It certainly seems like within the way this situation is described. You know, in our court of law today, you have the plaintiff and the accusers. They're on opposite sides. Even the courtroom, the way it's set up, is meant to be balanced. You don't have... Whereas here, it seems like the counsel is almost the ones holding him as the judges, right? He's coming before them. They seem to have a degree of the power that's involved here. And Paul is trying to appeal to them in reconciling this. So, very poor job summarizing what's taking place. But does anybody have anything they want to add about the last couple chapters? Any details? All right, so we'll look at chapter 23, verses 1 through 11 is where we'll start. And it says this, "And Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, 'Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day.' And the high priest Ananias commanded them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth. Then said Paul unto him, 'God shall smite thee, thou whited wall. For sittest thou to judge me after the law, and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law?' And they that stood by said, 'Revilest thou God's high priest?' Then said Paul, 'I wist not, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, Thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people. But when Paul perceived that the one part were Sadducees and the others Pharisees, he cried out in the council, 'Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, of the hope and resurrection of dead I am called in question.' And when he had so said, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the multitude was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. And there arose a great cry, and the scribes that were of the Pharisees apart arose and strove, saying, 'We find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God.' And when there arose a great dissension, the chief captain, fearing lest Paul should have been pulled into pieces of them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them, and to bring him into the castle or into the barracks. And the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, 'Be of good cheer, Paul, for as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome.'" All right, so Paul begins to address the Sanhedrin. Now remember, he's standing there, and the alleged claim against him is going to be blasphemy, which is a death, or is a punishment, or punishable by death, a crime punishable by death. And so the basic first thing he says is, "I've not done anything wrong. I'm not retracting anything. Until this day, I stand before a good conscience before God." The high priest Ananias commands that he be punched or smacked in the face and rebuked. Paul then rebukes him back and basically says, "Are you judging me according to the law and are breaking it while you're judging me?" The translators seem to make a very literal translation of a Hebrew idiom or proverb, which means a dirty wall that has been covered. Or in essence, he's saying, "You're a hypocrite. Right? That here you are judging me when you yourself are guilty of breaking the law, even in the manner in which you're judging me." And so that's obviously a harsh insult. However, a question I would pose to you is, it doesn't seem like Paul does anything wrong here, right, by calling that. That's definitely not a spirit of meekness at the same time, right? So, I guess what situations allow for such a response? Like, what about this situation? You know, Jesus obviously is standing before his shearers like a dumb lamb, right? Silent. Doesn't say a word. Goes to the slaughter without a word. Here, Paul is not going so quietly, not only in the way that the fact that he's contesting this, but also in the fact that he's insulting the high priest. And then the only thing he really apologizes for is the fact that he was the high priest and he didn't know that. He's not apologizing for what he said necessarily. So in what context is that appropriate?
Jesus, anytime the Pharisees were the way it was, you know, before they had him, he was really him too. Mm-hmm. And then when he was quiet, you know, before the high priest came, of course that was prophesied. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he stood as a lamb instead. I mean, he was to be sacrificed, you know, the offerings for our sake.
So what about the, because I agree with you, that Jesus obviously at times, he accuses them of almost the same exact thing. I guess what about this situation allows for that sort of a, I don't know, I don't want to say belligerent because that suggests sin, but just a insulting response, because that's obviously what it is they're insulting them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could almost say that sounds kind of like it was belligerent too, right?
Mm-hmm. So what about those situations?
It was righteous anger.
Mm-hmm.
Could there have been something else? Could Paul have been trying to present? I mean, what he was doing was a hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to point out his own hypocrisy, either to show him or the people around him that the high priest, by virtue of being a high priest alone, was not righteous. Mm-hmm. Could it have been something like that?
Just passionately reveal guilt?
Because he was hitting him with the law. Well, mm-hmm. Here are people who live by the law.
Mm-hmm.
But when he was talking to the Gentiles, he was not wanting to put the yoke of the law on mm-mm. the Gentiles. So what's the difference between them? One lives by the law, the other one never has lived by the law. So he's using the law to point out the
self-righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense, because you go into 24 and 26 and Felix and Agrippa, and like you said, he's much more delicate. He's even pleading with them. I know that thou believest, King Agrippa. None of this was done in a corner. Right? And so there's a sense to which he's gentle and convincing. Whereas here, he just, as they say, he did reviles the high priest. And that's what they accused him of. And that accusation's kind of accurate. Anybody else have a thought? So what about in modern day? In what context as Christians, you know, there's a sense to which I think people expect Christians just to always be gentle and soft-spoken, and if there's any kind of a heated passion that emerges, and we might say somebody, you're a hypocrite, or use some kind of an... Because to me, when you use an idiom, it's kind of doubly insulting. It's not like you're just saying, you hypocrite. But... you know, he's using this idiom to accentuate the insult or the crime or the flaw, the self-righteousness. And so in what context today is that, have you ever seen, I'll put it this way, have you ever seen that done by a Christian and thought, amen, that's right, that's exactly what needed to be said in the right way it needed to be said? Anybody?
Well, what should our goal as Christians be when we are talking to men? What should be the ultimate goal?
Well, in this case, I would say it was to reveal sin, point people to Christ.
Isn't that what Jesus' mission was
mm-hmm.
on this earth?
Mm-hmm.
So, shouldn't that be the purpose behind what we do?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was probably the purpose behind what Paul was doing.
You know, another thing, Paul is an authority figure here. I mean, he's doing the will of God. He's God's chosen for his purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas these high priests, they're going to claim that they are doing the Lord's work, but they're doing the
mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it just seems to me that he's just doing what's right and what needs to be said. It does make it tough, like you're saying. I guess what you're getting at, because Jesus is telling them to not take thought of what they can say when they're going to live it up. Mm-hmm. You know, back to asking them where they're at. It makes me wonder, am I supposed to keep my mouth shut all the time? But, I mean, look at the way they're acting so contemptuously toward him in this instance as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's hard to find fault in any kind of detail.
Absolutely, yeah. And I don't think there's fault. I think one thing that crossed my mind too is within different cultures of people, like projecting weakness is not going to be effective. So here you're with these men of power who, even in today's world leaders, you're not going to go before Vladimir Putin and say, hey, like, you've probably messed up a little bit. Right? It's not going to be effective. If you're going to speak to somebody of that culture and somebody of that, you're going to speak directly. And even though that could be offensive, there's still a degree of respect in the fact that you're not showing weakness and fear. Right? And I think, you know, different parts of American culture, there are groups within our culture that respect that. Just say it plainly. Don't mince words. And so perhaps, and Paul would have known these people, right? He would have known how to speak to these people. And so I do want to point out, he's just insulting them. He's pointing out their hypocrisy quite clearly. Now, he does something kind of interesting in the next part, and that is he recognizes that there are Pharisees and Sadducees. And it almost seems like a ploy to escape the situation. He says this comment that he knows is going to be controversial. Right? If there's something that you've probably learned by studying the scriptures, and a common thing that's pointed out is the main differences between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And that's concisely found in verse 8, where it says, "For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both." So these two groups, all were both Hebrew groups. They were very devoted. They both believed in the law very passionately. But there were some doctrinal issues that they disagreed on. And we can see how sensitive these groups are when they're together. Is that all Paul said? So they're in the middle of a trial. This man who has converted thousands, and they're knowledgeable of this, he's well known, his reputation preceded him coming into Jerusalem. You would think that their eyes would be fixed on, we finally got him. We're not going to let him go. We're going to put him to death. We're going to end this little group that has cut away from us called the Way, because here the leader's gone. And yet, what causes the fraction between these two groups is such a sensitive matter that all Paul says was, the reason I'm before you is because of the resurrection. And all of a sudden, they start fighting one another. And it gets such a sensitive situation that the chief captain's afraid that they're going to kill Paul in the process of fighting with each other. And so you can see. So I guess I would put this to you. What angle is Paul going for here?
End goal.
What's that?
End goal. He wants to go to Rome. But he's not meant to be tried by the Jews. So in order, he creates that dissension, create a highly charged environment where the Roman soldiers have to step in and take him away.
And there's risk in doing that.
Yeah.
Right? Because he's already suffered a beating the day before by these same people. And so, standing in the midst of this group and throwing that topic out there, he knows is going to lead to a lot of volatility, and it's on the brink of a violent altercation. Somebody else have a thought as to why he's responding this way, because we really don't learn about Rome until that night, where God gives him a clear assurance. Now, that's the Lord. He may have wanted to go to Rome before that, But in the next verse, or a couple of verses, we're going to see that God had predestined him to go to Rome, if I can use that word, right? Predetermined he was going to Rome. Anybody else have a thought as to why he creates this volatile situation?
He also frames the whole issue in such a way that he knew that the Pharisees couldn't condemn him for a statement like that, because in condemning him, they would have been condemning their own beliefs. Mm-hmm. So he knew of cause and sanction, but he also knew that the Pharisees, who were the power at the time, they couldn't condemn him for it.
And he could also use that as a springboard to talk about Jesus, right? Because ultimately that's what he's saying is the resurrection. He's not really talking about the general resurrection. He's referencing the resurrection of Jesus. Or that's what he's intending to use, which is kind of interesting. Somebody else have a thought about that? All right, so verse 11, we'll just look at a couple of those things real quick. It says, and the night following, the Lord stood by him. What did that mean? What does that mean? And the Lord stood by, or I'll ask you, has the Lord ever stood by you at night? In this same exact way, and I mean that sincerely. So you think that it was like an actual, like, road to Damascus appearance of Jesus? Okay. Somebody else?
I don't think it's out of the question.
Mm-hmm. Anybody think it's just a, I can't remember an exact occasion, but I think I've probably heard people say this at church before, something like this, you know, and the Lord was with me all night whenever we were at the hospital, right? That's a phrase that, so in either event, whether it's an actual appearance of the Lord or whether it's just an allusion to the presence of the Lord metaphysically being with him, we do have precise words which would lend towards more of a visible appearance. He says, be of good cheer, Paul, for as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome. Now, I would really encourage you to underline this verse or note this verse, because this is a promise that he's being given, and this promise is going to sustain him for years over much, throughout much peril. Because what this does not tell us is that you're going to go to Rome and you're not going to experience any pain or disappointment or deprivation or fear, or nothing. It doesn't say that. It just says, be of good cheer, you're making it to Rome. Now again, Paul has no idea that he's going to have quite a trip, and it's going to be full of much suffering. And yet, to me, this is a wonderful parallel to us, is that very often we can use our imaginations to take the promises of God and add details to them that are not there. When the Lord says, I'll always be with you, I'll never leave you or forsake you, that is not suggesting a painless experience. That's not suggesting feelings of loneliness will not occur, because they will. Now, just because I feel lonely doesn't mean I'm alone. And so, to me, it's just a needful thing to recognize that this promise does not equate just an easy path to fulfilling the promise. And I think very often much of the disappointment or anxiety or discouragement people feel is that they begin to doubt the promise because of the conditions up to the promise. I can see no way that this is going to occur despite the fact God has promised me this. And because I can't see it, I'm feeling rejected, discouraged, painful, doubtful. And then Satan capitalizes on that. Because what it ultimately is rooted in is calling into question the character of God. And if God is failing you, despite a promise to you, well, what do you do with anybody that fails you? You keep your distance. You keep this resentment that may not be on the surface of your relationship, but down deep, you're not attaching. You're not engaging. You're not fulfilling or seeking the meaningful part of the relationship, because really, you have a little bit of resentment towards God. Because it seems like the promise cannot occur that He has made to us. And this is going to be, I'm not saying these feelings are going to be how Paul's are, but certainly the conditions to fulfilling this promise are probably not as rosy as Paul thought in this moment, especially if Jesus' bodily presence was there with him. Be of good cheer, Paul. You're going to be shipwrecked. You're going to be bit by a viper. You're going to be, you know, all these things. He doesn't tell him any of that. He just says, I promise you, just like you've testified in Jerusalem, you're going to testify in Rome. And it's going to take years to get there. Now, even amongst those promises, I think very often the hardest part of awaiting the fulfillment of God's promises are not the conditions that lead there, but the time gap between the promise and the fulfillment. I think the scriptures allude to that over and over, is that in my own heart, the challenge is the time. And every day and every week and every month and year that passes, when the promise is unfulfilled, my faithless heart perhaps stores up doubt that I can fight for a while, but then it all seems to come rushing back at times and say, it's been 3 years, it's been 5 years, it's been 10 years, and I've endured shipwreck and I've endured this and I've endured that, but all that's worth it if it'll just happen. And Paul's about to go through that, and we're going to see. And so as we go through this, notice Paul's disposition as he goes through it. It doesn't appear like year after year that passes, this promise is an obstacle to him, or it not being fulfilled is an obstacle to him. It's like he's just accepted this is a marathon, and I'm okay if I'm in mile 10 and there's 16 miles to go and I'm exhausted right now. I'm okay. It's a marathon. I'm just going to keep on pacing myself until the end. Somebody have a thought?
Well, he's faced obstacles before this, lots of them. So why would it change? Mm-hmm. He knows that the Lord's work is difficult and Satan's there to throw everything at him. He's stoned in one place and hurt in another and try to get lynched by one mob. I mean, it's just... If he expected a rosy, I mean, there's nothing in me that would say Paul would expect a rosy trip to Rome.
And those things effectively prepared him for this, didn't they? So it's like in Acts 16 with the Philippian jailer and him being thrown in prison, like that has a important place in and among itself within that context. But that's the one awesome thing about God is it serves dual purposes. Because not only is it accomplishing something right then, right there with the Philippian jailer and with Silas and all the things that are going on there, but it's simultaneously preparing him for what's coming years in the future right here and this point on. And I think, I pray that you've experienced over years of being a Christian, you've seen in your own life the dual purposes of God in one or two events. Like you can see, God accomplished something right then, right there, bolstered my faith, changed my character, did this to me. But then it also served as a preparation for things when I would bear greater weights and more stress would test those weights. It was preparing me for that, and I didn't even think about 10 years from now. But I'm thankful that I had that preparation. That certainly, I'm glad you brought that up, seems to be something that's happening or has happened to Paul up to this point. Somebody else?
I feel like it reveals a lot about his heart too, that what brought him to Like, I thought about it if I was in that situation. The Lord said, you're going to live. Don't worry. Be of good cheer. You're going to live. You know, the things that would bring me cheer versus what brought him cheer was not, I'm going to deliver you from this situation. It's going to be, you're going to be able to continue to do this work. Mm-hmm. And it just reveals a lot of where his sight was set.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Just like in previous chapters, his detainment and death is not his concern at all. He didn't care. Now think about that. Think about in your own life getting to that place. The means of things that happen to you in this life doesn't matter anymore. So if you're taken to poverty, if your health is lost, if you're detained, if that's not as important as fulfilling the will of God in your life. That's the way the Christian life is meant to be. A sense of self-forgetfulness. Why does it matter how I feel anyway? What I think about the situation anyway? Isn't it what God wants what matters? Isn't that what the key is here? Now, in these next few verses, or this is kind of a quick series of events that occurs, and I don't have any spiritual insights to these things that take place or comments that take place really here, but it does continue our story. So if you look at verse 12, it says, "And when it was day, certain of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse or a covenant, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. And they were more than 40 which made this conspiracy. And they came to the chief priests and elders and said, we have bound ourselves under a great curse, that we will eat nothing until we have slain Paul. Now therefore, ye with the council signify to the chief captain that he bring him down unto you tomorrow, as though you would inquire something more perfectly concerning him. And we, or ever he come near, are ready to kill him." So, again, if this points out anything, it's the corruption of the religious establishment. When you have lost men, and this is why, you know, the whole, even in the last 30 years, the corruption of the Catholic hierarchy should not surprise anybody. When you have lost men comprising a religious hierarchy trying to, and politics gets involved, it's no different than any other political organization. And it may be even more corrupt because they're trying to be self-righteous. They know that they're the standards of morality, and so rather than confess and repent, you've got to scrub it clean so nobody knows about it. And so basically these men, these Pharisees, consent to this conspiracy, or rather the Sanhedrin does. And verse 16 tells us a fact about Paul that I'm not sure anywhere else in the scripture that we learn. "And when Paul's sister's son heard of their lying in wait." So, you know, from a different, this kind of opens up a different vantage point. I'm going to make a very passive point of this. Of just think, Paul is not just a single child with no parents, brothers and sisters, nephews and nieces. He has a family. Just like when Peter reveals to us about Peter's wife's mother was sick in the Gospels. Peter had a mother-in-law. He had a wife. He had family. And here we learn that Paul's nephew, and imagine being the nephew of the Apostle Paul, he hears of this conspiracy. He goes to the barracks and he tells Paul, now we're in verse 17, "Then Paul called one of the centurions unto him and said, bring this young man unto the chief captain, for he hath a certain thing to tell him. So he took him and brought him to the chief captain and said, Paul the prisoner called me unto him and prayed me to bring this young man unto thee, who has something to say unto thee. Then the chief captain took him by the hand." Now, as I read verse 19, so they've called him a young man, and then the chief captain takes him by the hand. So my natural rendering to this is he's young. Yeah, he's just something you would do with a, you know, 8, 9-year-old, 10-year-old, at least in our culture today. Of course, it could have been different back then. The chief captain took him by the hand and went with him aside privately and asked him, "What is it that thou hast to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to desire thee that thou wouldest bring down Paul tomorrow into the council, as though they would inquire something somewhat of him more perfectly. But do not thou yield unto them, for there lie in wait for him of them more than 40 men, which have bound themselves with an oath, and they neither eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now are they ready, looking for a promise from thee. So the chief captain then let the young man depart and charged him, see thou tell no man that thou hast showed these things to me. So anybody have any comments or thoughts about that? I think, that's pretty self-explanatory. I don't know if there's any comment really needed. Just kind of fleshes out more of the story and what they're about to do. So the chief captain obviously takes this seriously, very seriously, because of what he's about to do. Verses 23 through 35, it says this, "And he called unto him two centurions, saying, Make ready 200 soldiers to go to Caesarea, and horsemen 70, and spearmen 200. So we have 470 men of the Roman soldiers that are going. 70 horsemen, 200 spearmen, and 200 foot soldiers are going at the third hour of the night. And provided them beasts that they may set Paul on and bring him safe unto Felix the governor." So now they're transferring this case from just being before reconciling or trying to trying to reconcile with the actual accusers to now, I'm passing this along to the civil court system. So this Felix is going to be the governor that's responsible for this. And Claudius Lysias is the one that is the chief captain. And so he's going to write the following letter. And if you turn your next page real quick, I just kind of wrote out that letter in what we would say today is in a letter form, right? So taking away all the verses, taking away the breaks, this is how it would read something like this. It's the bottom of page 4. It just says, "Claudius Lysias unto the most excellent governor Felix sendeth greeting. This man was taken of the Jews and should have been killed of them. Then came I with an army and rescued him, having understood that he was a Roman. And when I would have known the cause wherefore they accused him, I brought him forth into their council, whom I perceived to be accused of questions of their law, but have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or of bonds. And when it was told me how that the Jews laid wait for the man, I sent straightway to thee, and gave commandment to his accusers also to say before thee what they had against him. Farewell." All right, so that's the letter. And if you'll go back to page 3, I think it's page 3. Nope, it'd be page 4. Verse 31, the reading continues. So it says this, "Then the soldiers, as it was commanded them, took Paul and brought him by night unto Antipatris." I think that's how you say that. "On the morrow they left the horsemen to go with him and return to the castle, who, when they came to Caesarea and delivered the epistle to the governor, presented Paul also before him. And when the governor had read the letter, he asked of what province he was. And when he understood that he was of Cilicia, I will hear thee, said he, when thine accuser are also come. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's judgment hall." So if you look at page 4, this gives us a visual of what route they likely took from Jerusalem. So this is roughly a 65-mile journey from where he's at to where he's going. So they travel evidently 30 miles at one point, and that's in the city of Antipatris. They stop there overnight, and then they continue and finish their 35 miles there into Caesarea. They leave at 9 in the morning, and they've obviously got this letter to accompany Paul. And basically, the chief captain gives a little bit of his opinion about the matter, which is going to be a common theme throughout the book of Acts, is every step of the way, basically every person is going to say, I don't agree with him, but even some may say he's crazy, but there's nothing worthy of death or imprisonment that he's done. It just seems like something that has to do with their religious laws, which is not the purview of the Roman court. Nonetheless, it had been appealed to go there, and so Felix was the one that had the power to do something about it. And so, obviously, this case is less about the legal and more about the social implications. We see that today with certain high-profile cases. Is that the actual law broken and the actual things done are not that big of a deal, but the social implications of that are going to have far-reaching effect. And so it seems like this chief captain is quick to abandon this because he's saying, hey, I don't see any big deal with this thing. I could probably dismiss this case, but the social implications could lead to an upheaval in the place where I'm the chief captain. I don't want that responsibility. If you're going to overturn, or if you're going to set him free, do it 65 miles away from here. I don't want to have anything to do with the implications from the fallout from releasing Paul. Now, what we're going to learn in the next case is that Paul gets there safely, so that oath that these men had made was thwarted because of the information that they were given. And in the next chapter, we're going to see that they hire an attorney. The Sanhedrin hire an attorney to represent them against Paul. Paul does no such thing. He gladly represents himself, and he states even as much that he wanted to represent himself and tell his side of the story against these allegations that were made against him. And so, chapter 24, we're going to see him standing before Felix, and in a very real way, his life is at stake. In a legal way, his imprisonment or being bound is going to be at stake. He could be punished, scourging, whatever. Neither of those things Paul seems concerned with based upon the testimony he gives before the judge. His angle is all of their souls. And that's going to be the same case in chapter 6. And again, I emphasize that point because how many things in life do we face that on the surface it's about this, and on a different angle it's about this, but God could use the situation for a deeper meaning, for an eternal purpose? And how often are we so short-sighted in seeing the natural causes effect as it relates to my relationship with my family or my friend or my employer? Or how much do we think in all of these natural ways is where our mind goes, and we analyze and we make provision for and adjustments for all these natural things? And Paul seems not to be mindful of any of that. All he is thinking about is the gospel of Christ and the message of Christ getting to as many people. And every time the platform that he's on rises a little bit and his audience gets a little bit bigger, and at the same time, the stakes and the jeopardy he's in grows, he never seems to shy away from just focusing on the spiritual every single time. And I think in the way of practical application, I hope that we would consider that. That as we analyze with our natural sight all the causes and effects as they relate to the flesh, how many things that are going on in our life, our health, our situations of family, the health of our family, our financial struggles, what if all of those things are just tools God is using? None of those things are the things that God cares much about at all. And so though your financial vulnerability is of the utmost fear in your mind, though your kids' rebellion is of the utmost fear in your mind, though your employment is of the utmost fear in your mind, what if God's purposes behind all that are spiritual as they relate to you? And the anxieties that are provoked by those situations is God maturing your faith, trying your faith, growing you. I think most of the time that's what it is. We just don't want it to be that. We're so, as I mentioned Sunday, we're so obsessed with the idol of circumstance. I just want to get away from this circumstance because it is dead center in the middle of my vulnerability. I want to get away from it. And God says, no. Because pressing this nerve is the means to maturing you. And again, on one hand you pray, God, draw me nearer to you. God, break me for the heart of lost people. And God says, okay. He just answers it different than what we expected. Here it just seems like Paul's desire, I want to reach the world, is Paul's desire. And God says, okay. You're going to be beaten. You're going to be shipwrecked. You're going to be... And even like the things the scripture doesn't mention, like imagine just sitting in prison night after night and all the people you're around. The food you're eating. The cold outside. Imagine how bad you would stink. Imagine all the sores that you have all over your body from all the beatings. And it's just exposed. Paul's experiencing all of that. And I think about how big of a sissy that I am as it relates to those things. That those little things can become such controlling forces in my life. Right? I have a cough that I can't shake for weeks and weeks and weeks. And so I'm just angry at the world for weeks and weeks and weeks. And it's so silly and trivial, and yet it consumes and dictates so much of my response. Paul is going through all of that. It's just the scripture doesn't mention it. But it's natural to his situation. And he doesn't just... His eyes are still on the prize. He's still looking to get the gospel to other people. And to me, that's one of the many reasons why Paul is just this incredible example that can rightfully say to people, follow me as I follow Christ. And although he was not perfect and although he made mistakes, man, the example that he has in these situations, his eyes are on serving the Lord. And, you know, he died poor. He died a martyr. He died in the hands of the Romans. What a better way to die. You know, like as he's writing the last book that he writes, 2 Timothy, and he's like, I've finished my course. I'm done. I've done what the Lord, and like, what a way to finish your life. What God set out for me, I have finished it. And now he doesn't say, but I'm really afraid that they're going to kill me. Or, man, my shoulder's been dislocated for years. And it really hurts. He doesn't say any of that. Right? His eyes are on the spiritual. And for that reason, I just want to put him before you as a tremendous example. Because he is one. And one worthy of bringing before us. Anybody else have a comment before we're done tonight? All right. Well, that's all I have for this evening. Like I said, this story was kind of a straightforward one, kind of a more of a transitional story, and where we're going to go in the next chapter. There's a lot more spiritual things to look at in the next chapter, I think. Anybody have anything tonight?